Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Mistake of Law and Reasonable Suspicion Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On October 6, 2014, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Hyen v. North Carolina. The question in this case is whether a police officer's mistaken understanding of a law can provide the reasonable suspicion that the Fourth Amendment requires to justify a traffic stop. To discuss the case, we have Ryan Scott, who is an associate professor of law at the Indiana University Maurer School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Scott.
Hello, my name is Ryan Scott. I'm an associate professor at Indiana University's Maurer School of Law, and today I'll be talking about Hyen versus North Carolina, a case argued at the first session of the Supreme Court's 2014 term just 2 weeks ago on October 6, 2014. The question in the case is whether a police officer's reasonable mistake of law can provide the individualized suspicion required to justify a traffic stop under the Fourth Amendment. In Hyen, a police officer in North Carolina pulled over a vehicle because one but not both of the rear brake lights was working. And it turns out North Carolina's traffic laws require only that a vehicle maintain a stop lamp, singular. And in this case, the North Carolina Court of Appeals held for the first time as a matter of state law that based on that statutory language, it's perfectly lawful to drive around in the state of North Carolina with only one working taillight. The North Carolina Supreme Court held, without commenting on the statutory issue, that the police officer acted reasonably in pulling over the vehicle because several other provisions of the state statutes referred to rear lamps in the plural. So the officer's mistake about what the law meant was reasonable within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. Most federal courts of appeals and state supreme courts to consider this question, it turns out, have reached the opposite conclusion. They've held that a mistake of law, no matter how reasonable, cannot justify a traffic stop. So reasonable suspicion of conduct that turns out to be perfectly legal is never reasonable search within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. And the Supreme Court in this case agreed to resolve the conflict. It's an important case, and it's the latest in a series in which the court has narrowed the Fourth Amendment and the exclusionary rule in cases involving good faith errors of one kind or another by police officers. These are cases where the court is fond of saying that the guilty might go free because the constable blundered. This case, it happens, involves an ambiguous and never before construed state law provision. But it might have implications in all sorts of other contexts. For example, what about statutes as to which there's a conflict of opinions, if there are two courts of appeals in the state or federal courts that have reached opposite conclusions and the police rely on the broader, more aggressive, those interpretations? What about state laws expressed as standards rather than rules? So this case involves a very simple law. Either state law requires both taillights to be working or just one. But many criminal laws involve standards as to which it's hard to predict what the application will be. A statute might make it a crime to make unreasonable noise at night or to drive with excessive speed in light of the adverse weather conditions. And what if a police officer makes an arrest or conducts a search based on a reasonable mistake about the application of that uncertain and unpredictable flexible standard as opposed to a bright line rule? And an issue that was actually mentioned in the oral argument, what about good faith mistakes of constitutional law? If there's a reasonable mistake by a police officer about, for example, the existence of exigent circumstances justifying a warrantless arrest, or about the probable cause or reasonable suspicion standards themselves, which are flexible standards and not easily reduced to bright line rules. So Mr. Hyen, represented by Jeff Fisher at the Supreme Court Clinic at Stanford Law School, argues that a mistake of law cannot serve as a basis for probable cause, noting that many laws, state laws, are ambiguous. Traffic laws with ambiguities like this are quite common. That could dramatically expand the scope and discretion of police to conduct stops and searches and have no power to exclude the evidence as a consequence. He also notes that defendants are, of course, on the hook to know the law. Ignorance of the law is no excuse for criminal defendants, even if it's a perfectly reasonable mistake of law. That's the general rule. And police officers, the argument goes, should be held to the same standard. On the other hand, the Supreme Court has held in a number of contexts that mistakes by police can nonetheless serve as a basis for probable cause. Reasonable mistakes of fact have long been sufficient to support probable cause. And in a series of cases, the court has also upheld searches despite legal errors by police officers. So in a case called DeFilippino in 1979, the court held that it was reasonable for the police to rely on a substantive statute, even though it was later determined to be unconstitutional. And in a case called Krull in 1987, the court declined to exclude evidence when relying on police relied on a search statute, a statute that explicitly authorized a search. Again, that statute was later determined unconstitutional, but the court held that the exclusion of the evidence was unwarranted. Most recently, in a case called Davis in 2011, the court held that there was no warrant for the exclusion of evidence where a court of appeals decision had expressly authorized the kind of search that the police undertook, but that court of appeals decision was later overruled by the Supreme Court or abrogated by the Supreme Court. The court said that no exclusion of evidence was warranted. So the state and the Justice Department, based on those cases, proposed that a reasonable mistake of law should be treated the same way. If the officer's view of state law was objectively reasonable at the time of the search, then it's reasonable within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. Reasonable means legally reasonable, in addition to a reasonable assessment of the facts, for example. The petitioner tries to distinguish those cases by drawing a distinction between rights and remedies, and this turned out to be quite important at the argument. So the briefs draw a distinction between violating the Fourth Amendment and the separate question whether exclusion of the evidence is warranted for that violation. So the petitioner contends that a reasonable mistake of law would matter, if at all, only to the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule and not to the more basic question whether there was a violation of the Fourth Amendment in the first instance. And that's the question that the court agreed to review. So oral argument happened a couple weeks ago, and let me make a couple of observations about what the justices' questions for the parties likely signal about how they're thinking about the case. First, and this was quite surprising, the court spent a lot of time trying to sort out the difference between this rights issue and remedies issue. The petitioner's view that we can resolve this case based solely on the question whether there was a violation of the Fourth Amendment without talking about good faith and the exclusionary rule is premised on the fact that the North Carolina courts have rejected the good faith exception for violations of the state constitution's search and seizure provision. So the theory of the petitioners apparently is that we could get a favorable resolution by having the Supreme Court decide that this was a violation and withhold judgment on whether the remedy should include exclusion of the evidence, because the North Carolina courts would say, we don't care whether there's about the Supreme Court's good faith jurisprudence. We've rejected it across the board. The justices pushed hard on that premise at oral argument, at one point even getting Jeff Fisher to concede that the best he could get in this case was a remand. Justices Scalia, Sotomayor, and Kennedy all expressed concern about resolving this violation issue, the rights question, without any discussion of the remedy question, if it wouldn't make any difference because the remedy would be resolved in a different way by the North Carolina courts. Mr. Fisher insisted that the court could do so, just as it routinely considers constitutional questions on the merits and then remands for consideration of whether the issue was harmless, for example. And the state seemed to agree with that premise. Nonetheless, some uncertainty about how the court ought to resolve that with the two justices, Justices Scalia and Kennedy, suggesting that review of this question might not be proper if they were prohibited or unable to consider the remedy question along with the question of underlying rights. That said, and a second observation, the court also had a very interesting discussion of what a reasonable mistake of law might look like. I'd say, in general, it seemed like the court was sympathetic to the arguments by the state and the United States, which agreed with North Carolina and urged that the court affirm the judgment below, as to the general premise that a reasonable mistake of law in some circumstances ought to be no barrier to the admission of evidence at trial, as long as whether it's phrased as a right or a remedy issue, that the reasonable mistake of law ought to bear on that question. But there was a lot of discussion of what a reasonable mistake looks like, and in particular discussion of analogous contexts in which similar questions about ambiguities and uncertainty of law comes up, especially the qualified immunity context. Qualified immunity being the doctrine that insulates police officers and other executive officials from civil liability in cases where they've acted contrary to clearly established law. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Breyer and Justice Sotomayor, at different points in the argument, all expressed discomfort with the approach proposed by the state of North Carolina, which would essentially adopt qualified immunity-style rules. Was the interpretation reasonable? Was it plausible? Could reasonable people disagree about the interpretation of the statute? That struck Chief Justice Roberts as troubling because it was awfully broad. It would mean that lots of police searches and seizures would have to be upheld in light of ambiguous state statutes. The United States made a wise decision, tactically and, in my opinion, substantively, by proposing a narrower rule. The federal government's argument was that an officer's mistake should be deemed reasonable only if it has, they've used the phrase, a foothold in the statute. So whereas qualified immunity is generally available unless there's some authority that forecloses police action, the assistant to the Solicitor General, Rachel Kovner, who argued the case, said that the rule in this context should be, the presumption should be flipped, that a reasonable mistake for Fourth Amendment purposes should be available only if the statute somehow affirmatively supports the officer's view. And the government said that's the case here. There's some statutory language that seemed quite consistent with the officer's reading that all of the operating taillights, all of the taillights needed to operate, rather than just any of them. If I had to hazard a guess based on the questioning of the court, I'd predict that the court will affirm in this case, but along those narrower lines. I think that's likely to garner a broader support among the court. And I expect also that they'll reserve some of these trickier questions about circuit conflicts and about ambiguous extant precedent about Fourth Amendment law itself for future cases. But there's something of a wild card here because of the court's discomfort with being called upon to answer only the rights question and the fact that the remedies question wasn't briefed by the parties, and there's some concern about the proper disposition of a case in those circumstances, that it's a little hard to tell how the court will ultimately come out. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.